Chapter 1. He will choose the fate of the weak. He will win and break his chains. He will choose how he will be loved. He will strengthen himself through sacrifice. He will make a pet. He will strengthen himself through pain. He will balance between peace and conflict. He will know brotherhood. He will remake himself. He will immortalize his love. Common Themes in Prophecies Recorded in the Symbology of Knotted Tassels by Dr. Hylan Rotham, University of Pangalactic Cultural Studies. Call for papers. The university invites submissions from cupulogists and fiber record analysts on the subject of the remaining untranslated tassels from the Lord artifact. Symposium dates may change, subject to current security situation. Sith Meditation Sphere, heading Coruscant, estimated. It was odd having to trust a ship. Ben Skywalker was alone in the vessel he'd found on Zeost, trusting it to understand that he wanted it to take him home. No navigation array, no controls, no pilot seat, nothing. Through the bulkheads he could see stars as smeared points of light, but he'd stopped finding the ship's transparency unsettling. The hull was there. He could both see it and not see it. He felt he was in the heart of a hollowed red gem, making its sedate way back to the core. And there was no yoke or physical control panel, so he had to think his command. The strange ship, more like a ball of rough red stone than a vessel made in a shipyard, responded to the Force. "Can't you go faster? I'll be an old man by the time I get back." The ship felt instantly annoyed. Ben listened. In his mind, the ship spoke in a male voice that had no sound or real form. But it spoke, and it wasn't amused by his impatience. It showed him streaked white lights streaming from a central point in a black void, a pilot's view of hyperspace, and then an explosion. "Okay, so you're going as fast as you can." Ben felt the ship's brief satisfaction that its idiot pilot had understood. He wondered who'd made it. It was hard not to think of it as alive, like the Yuuzhan Vong ships, but he settled for seeing it as a droid, an artifact with a personality, and, yes, emotions, like Shaker. "Sorry, Shaker. Sorry to leave you to sort it all out." The astromech droid would be fine, he knew it. Ben had dropped him off on Drua. That was where Shaker came from, like Kiara, and so they were both home now. Astromechs were good, reliable, sensible units, and Shaker would hand her over to someone to take care of her. Poor kid. Her dad's dead, and her whole life's upended. They were just used to lure me to Zeost so someone could try to kill me. Why? Have I made that many enemies already? The ship felt irritated again, leaving Ben with the impression that he was being whiny, but he said nothing. Ben didn't enjoy having his thoughts examined. He made a conscious effort to control his wandering mind. The ship knew his will, spoken or unspoken, and he still wasn't sure what the consequences of that might be. Right then it made him feel invaded, and the relief at finding the ancient ship and managing to escape Zeost in it had given way to worry, anger, and resentment. And impatience. He had a comlink, but he didn't want to advertise his presence in case there were other ships pursuing him. He'd destroyed one. That didn't mean there weren't others. The amulet wasn't that important. So why am I a target now? The ship wouldn't have gone any faster if he'd had a seat and a yoke to occupy himself, but he wouldn't have felt so lost. He could almost hear Jason reminding him that physical activity was frequently displacement, and that he needed to develop better mental discipline to rise above fidgeting restlessness. An unquiet mind wasn't receptive, he said. Ben straightened his legs to rub a sore knee, then settled again cross-legged to try meditating. It was going to be a long journey. The bulkheads and deck were amber pumice, and from time to time the surfaces seemed to burn with a fire embedded in the material. Whoever had made it had had a thing about flames. Ben tried not to think flame in case the ship interpreted it as a command. But it wasn't that stupid. It could almost think for him. He reached inside his tunic and felt the amulet. The stupid, worthless thing that didn't seem to be an instrument of great Sith power after all, just a fancy bauble that Kiara's dad had been sent to deliver. Now the man was dead, all because of Ben, and the worst thing was that Ben didn't know why. I need to find Jason. Jason wasn't stupid either, and it was hard to believe he'd been duped about the amulet. Maybe it was part of some plan. If it was, Ben hoped it was worth Faskus's life and Kiara's misery. That's my mission. Put the amulet of Kalara in Jason's hands. Nothing more, nothing less. Jason could be anywhere now, in his offices on Coruscant, on the front line of some battle, hunting subversives. Maybe this weird force-controlled ship could tap in and locate him. He'd be on the Holonews. He always was. Colonel Jason Solo, head of the Galactic Alliance Guard, all-around public hero holding back the threats of a galaxy. Okay, I'm feeling sorry for myself. Stop it. He couldn't land this ship on a Coruscant strip and stroll away from it as if it were just a TIE fighter he'd salvaged. People would ask awkward questions. He wasn't even sure what it was. And that meant it was one for Jason to sort out. Okay, Ben said aloud. Can you find Jason Solo? Have you got a way of scanning comlinks? Can you find him in the Force? The ship suggested he ought to be able to do that himself. Ben concentrated on Jason's face in his mind, and then tried to visualize the Anakin Solo, which was harder than he thought. The sphere ship seemed to be ignoring him. He couldn't feel its voice. Even when it wasn't addressing him or reacting to him, there was a faint background noise in his mind that gave him the feeling the vessel was humming to itself, like someone occupied with a repetitive task. Can you do it? If it can't, I'll try to land inside the GAG compound and hope for the best. You don't want Galactic Alliance engineers crawling all over you with hydrospanners, I bet. The ship told him to be patient, and that it had nothing a hydrospanner could grip anyway. Ben occupied himself with trying to pinpoint Jason before the ship could, but Jason's trick of hiding in the Force had become permanent. Ben found he was impossible to track unless he wanted to be found, and right then there was nothing of him, not a whisper or an echo. Ben thought he might have more luck persuading the ship to seek Holonews channels, or maybe it was so old that it didn't have the technology to find those frequencies. Hey, come on. If it managed to destroy a freighter on the power of my thoughts alone, it can find a Holonews signal. Ah, said the ship. Ben's mind was suffused with a real sense of discovery. The ship dropped out of hyperspace for a moment and seemed to cast around. And then it felt as if it had found something. The starfield, visible somehow, even though the fiery, rocky bulkheads were still there, skewed as the ship changed course and jumped back into hyperspace. It radiated a sense of happy satisfaction, seeming almost excited. Found him? The ship said it had found what it was seeking. Ben decided not to engage it in a discussion of how it could find a shut-down Jason hiding in the Force. Well, let me know when we get within 10,000 clicks, Ben said. I can risk using the comlink then. The ship didn't answer. It hummed happily to itself, silent, but filling Ben's head with ancient harmonies of a kind he'd never imagined sounds could create. Colonel Jason Solo's cabin, Star Destroyer Anakin Solo, extended course, heading 000, Coruscant via the Contrum system. None of the crew of the Anakin Solo seemed to find it odd that the ship was taking an extraordinarily circuitous course back to Coruscant. Jason sensed the general resigned patience. It was what they expected from the head of the Galactic Alliance Guard, and they asked no questions. He also sensed Ben Skywalker, and it was taking every scrap of his concentration to focus on his apprentice and locate him. He's okay, I know it, but something didn't go as planned. Jason homed in on a point of blue light on the bridge repeater set in the bulkhead. He felt Ben at the back of his mind, the way he might smell a familiar but elusive scent, the kind that was so distinctive as to be unmistakable. Unharmed, alive, well, but something wasn't right. The disturbance in the force, a faint prickling sharpness at the back of his throat that he'd never felt before, made Jason anxious. These days he didn't like what he didn't know. It was a stark contrast with the days when he had wandered the galaxy in search of the esoteric and the mysterious for the sake of new force knowledge. Of late, he wanted certainty. He wanted order, and order of his own making. I wasn't ridding the galaxy of chaos then. Times have changed. I'm responsible for worlds now, not just myself. Ben's mission would have taken him... where, exactly? Zeost. Pinpointing a 14-year-old boy, not even a ship, just 55 kilos of humanity, in a broad corridor coiling around the Perlemian trade route, was a tall order even with help from the Force. He's got a secure comlink, but he won't use it. I taught him to keep transmissions to a minimum. But, Ben, if you're in trouble, you have to break silence. Jason waited, staring through the shifting displays and readouts that mirrored those on the operations consoles at the heart of the ship. He'd started to lose the habit of waiting for the Force to reveal things to him. It was easy to do after taking so much into his own hands and forcing destiny in the last few months. Somewhere in the Anakin Solo, he felt Lumia as a swirling eddy eating away at a riverbank. He let go and magnified his presence in the Force. Ben. I'm here, Ben. The more Jason relaxed and let the Force sweep him up, and it was now hard to let go and be swept, much harder than harnessing its power, the more he had a sense of Ben being accompanied. Then he had a sense of Ben seeking him out, groping to find him. He has something with him. Can't be the amulet, of course. He'll be angry I sent him on an exercise in the middle of a war. I'll have to explain that very, very carefully. It had just been a feint to get him free of Luke and Mara for a while, to give him some space to be himself. Ben wasn't the Skywalker's little boy any longer. He would take on Jason's mantle one day, and that wasn't a task for an overprotected child who'd never been allowed to test himself far from the overwhelmingly long shadow of his Jedi Grandmaster father. "You're a lot tougher than they think, aren't you, Ben?" Jason felt the faint echo of Ben turn back on him and become an insistent pressure at the back of his throat. He took a breath, Now they both knew they were looking for each other. He snapped out of his meditation and headed for the bridge. All stop. The bridge was in semi-darkness, lit by the haze of soft green and blue light spilling from status displays that drained the color from the faces of the hand-picked, totally loyal crew. Jason walked up to the main viewport and stared out at the stars as if he might see something. "Hold this station. We're waiting for a ship, I believe." Lieutenant Tebbutt, current officer of the watch, glanced up from the console without actually raising her head. It gave her an air of disapproval, but it was purely a habit.
"If you could narrow that down, sir."
"I don't know what kind of ship," Jason said, "but I'll know it when I see it."
"Right you are, sir."
They waited. Jason was conscious of Ben, much more focused and intense now, a general mood of business as usual in the ship, and the undercurrent of Lumia's restlessness. Closing his eyes, he felt Ben's presence more strongly than ever. Tebbutt put her fingertip to her ear as if she'd heard something in her bead-sized earpiece.
"Unidentified vessel on intercept course. Range 10,000 kilometers off the port beam."
A pinpoint of yellow light moved against a constellation of colored markers on the holomonitor. The trace was small, perhaps the size of a starfighter, but it was a ship, closing in at speed.
"I don't know exactly what it is, sir."
The officer sounded nervous. Jason was briefly troubled to think he now inspired fear for no apparent reason.
"It doesn't match any heat signature or drive profile we have. No indication if it's armed. No transponder signal either."
It was one small vessel. And this was a star destroyer. It was a curiosity rather than a threat. But Jason took nothing for granted. There were always traps. This didn't feel like one, but he still couldn't identify that otherness he sensed.
"It's decelerating, sir."
"Let me know when you have a visual." Jason could almost taste where it was, and considered bringing the Anakin Solo about so he could watch the craft become a point of the reflected light of Contruum's star, then expand into a recognizable shape. But he didn't need to. The tracking screen gave him a better view. "Ready cannons. And don't open fire except on my order." In Jason's throat, on a line level with the base of his skull, there was the faint tingling of someone's anxiety. Ben knew the Anakin Solo was getting a firing solution on him. "Easy, Ben."
"Contact in visual range, sir."
Tebbutt sounded relieved. The screen refreshed, changing from a schematic to a real image that only she and Jason could see. She tapped her finger on the transparasteel.
"Good grief! Is that you, Jean Vong?"
It was a disembodied eye with double, well, wings on each side. There was no other word to describe them. Membranes stretched between jointed fingers of veins like webbing. The dull amber surface seemed covered in a tracery of blood vessels. For a brief moment, Jason thought it was precisely that, an organic ship, a living vessel and ecosystem in its own right, of the kind that only the hated Yuuzhan Vong invaders had created. But it was somehow too regular, too constructed. Clustered spires of spiked projections rose from the hull like a compass rose, giving it a stylized, cross-like appearance. Somewhere in his mind, Lumia had become very alert and still.
"I knew the Yuuzhan Vong well," said Jason, "and that's not quite their style."
The audio link made a fizzing sound and then popped into life.
"This is Ben Skywalker.
Anakin Solo, this is Ben Skywalker of the Galactic Alliance Guard. Hold your fire. Please.
There was a collective sigh of amused relief on the bridge. Jason thought that the fewer personnel who saw the ship, and the sooner it docked in the hangar, to be hidden with sheeting from curious eyes, the better.
You're alone, Skywalker?
Technically, Ben was a junior lieutenant, but Skywalker would do. Ben wouldn't. Not now that he had the duties of a grown man.
No passengers?
Only the ship. Sir.
Permission to dock.
Jason glanced around at the bridge crew and nodded to Tebbutt.
Kill the visual feed. Treat this craft as classified. Nobody discusses it. Nobody saw it. And we never took it on board. Understood?
Yes, sir. I'll clear all personnel from Zeta Hangar area. Just routine safety procedure.
Tebbutt was just like Captain Chevu and Corporal LeCouf. Utterly reliable.
Good thinking, Jason said. I'll see Skywalker safely docked. Give me access to the bay hatches.
Jason made his way down to the deck, resisting the urge to break into a run as he took the shortest route through passages and down durasteel ladders into the lower section of the hull, well away from the busy starfighter hangars. Droids and crew going about their duties seemed surprised to see him. When he reached Zeta Hangar, the speckled void of space was visible through the gaping hatch that normally admitted supply shuttles, and the reflection he caught sight of in the transparisteel airlock barrier was that of a man slightly disheveled from anxious haste. He needed a haircut. He could also sense Lumia.
So, what brings you down here?
He asked, deactivating the deck security holocam.
Hero's homecoming?
She emerged from the shadow of an engineering access shaft, face half veiled. Her eyes betrayed a little fatigue. The faintest of blue circles ringed them. The fight with Luke must have taken it out of her.
The ship,
she said.
Look.
A veined sphere, 10 meters across, filled the aperture of the hatch, its wing-like panels folded back. It hovered silently for a moment, and then settled gently in the center of the deck. The hatch doors closed behind it. It was a few moments before the hangar repressurized, and an opening appeared in the sphere's casing to eject a ramp.
Ben did very well to pilot it,
Lumia said.
He did well to locate me.
She melted back into the shadows, but Jason knew she was still there watching as he walked up to the ramp. Ben emerged from the opening in grubby civilian clothing. He didn't look pleased with himself. If anything, he looked wary and sullen, as if expecting trouble. He also looked suddenly older. Jason reached out and squeezed his cousin's shoulder, feeling suppressed energy in him.
Well, you certainly know how to make an entrance, Ben. Where did you get this?
Hi, Jason.
Ben reached into his tunic, and when he withdrew his hand, a silver chain dangled from his fist. The amulet of Kalara. It exuded dark energy, almost like a pungent perfume that clung and wouldn't go away.
You asked me to get this, and I did.
Jason held out his hand. Ben placed the gem-inlaid amulet in his palm, coiling the chain on top of it. Physically, it felt quite ordinary, a heavy and rather vulgar piece of jewelry. But it gave him a feeling like a weight passing through his body and settling in the pit of his stomach. He slipped it inside his jacket.
You did well, Ben.
I found it on Zeost, in case you want to know. And that's where I got the ship, too. Someone tried to kill me, and I grabbed the first thing I could to escape.
The attempt on Ben's life didn't hit Jason as hard as the mention of Zeost, the Sith homeworld. Jason hadn't bargained on that. Ben wasn't ready to hear the truth about the Sith, or that he was apprenticed, informally or not, to the man destined to be the master of the Order. Jason felt no reaction from Lumia whatsoever, but she had to be hearing this. She was still lurking. It was a dangerous mission, but I knew you could handle it.
Lumia, you arranged this. What's your game?
Who tried to kill you?
A Bothan set me up, Ben said. Dure. He paid a courier to take the amulet to Zeost, framed him as the thief, and the guy ended up dead. I got even with the Bothan, though. I blew up the ship that was targeting me. I hope it was Dure's.
How? Ben gestured over his shoulder with his thumb.
It's armed. It seems to have whatever weapons you want.
Well done. Jason got the feeling that Ben was suspicious of the whole galaxy right then. His blue eyes had a gray cast, as if someone had switched off the enthusiastic light in him. That was what made him look older. A brush with a hostile world, another step away from his previous protected existence, and an essential part of his training.
Ben, treat this as top secret. The ship is now classified, like your mission. Not a word to anyone.
Like I was going to write to Mom and Dad about it. What I did on my vacation, by Ben Skywalker, age 14 and 2 weeks.
Ouch. Ben was no longer gung-ho and blindly eager to please. But that was a good thing in a Sith apprentice. Jason changed tack. Birthdays had a way of making you take stock if you spent them somewhere unpleasant.
How did you fly this? I've never seen anything like it.
Ben shrugged and folded his arms tight across his chest, his back to the vessel. But he kept looking around as if to check that it was still there.
You think what you want it to do, and it does it. You can even talk to it. But it doesn't have any proper controls.
He glanced over his shoulder again.
It talks to you through your thoughts, and it doesn't have a high opinion of me.
A Sith ship. Ben had flown a Sith ship back from Zeost. Jason resisted the temptation to go inside and examine it.
You need to get back home. I told your parents I didn't know where you were, and hinted they might have made you run off by being overprotective.
Ben looked a little sullen.
Thanks.
It's true, though. You know it is.
Jason realized he hadn't said what really mattered.
Ben, I'm proud of you.
He sensed a faint glow of satisfaction in Ben that died down almost as soon as it began.
I'll file a full report if you want.
As soon as you can.
Jason steered him toward the hangar exit.
Probably better that you don't arrive home in this ship. We'll shuttle you to the nearest safe planet, and you can get a more conventional ride on a passenger flight.
I need some credits for the fare. I'm fed up with stealing to get by.
Of course.
Ben had done the job and proved he could survive on his wits. Jason realized the art of building a man was to push him hard enough to toughen him without alienating him. It was a line he explored carefully. He fished in his pocket for a mix of denominations in untraceable cred coins.
Here you go. Now get something to eat, too.
With one last look at the sphere ship, Ben gave Jason a casual salute before striding off in the direction of the store's turbo lift. Jason waited.
The ship watched him. He felt it. Not alive, but aware. Eventually he heard soft footsteps on the deck behind him, and the ship somehow seemed to ignore him and look elsewhere.
"A Sith meditation sphere," said Lumia.
"An attack craft. A fighter."
"It's ancient. Absolutely ancient."
She walked up to it and placed her hand on the hull. It seemed to have melted down into a near hemisphere. The vanes and, Jason assumed, systems masts on its keel tucked beneath it. Right then it reminded him of a pet crouching before its master, seeking approval. It actually seemed to glow like a fanned ember.
"What a magnificent piece of engineering."
Lumia's brow lifted, and her eyes creased at the corners. Jason guessed that she was smiling, surprised.
"It says it's found me."
It was an unguarded comment, rare for Lumia, and almost an admission. Ben had been attacked on a test that Lumia had set up. The ship came from Zeost. Circumstantially, it wasn't looking good.
"It was searching for you."
She paused again, listening to a voice he couldn't hear.
"It says that Ben needed to find you. And when it found you, it also recognized me as Sith and came to me for instructions."
"How did it find me? I can't be sensed in the Force if I don't want to be. And I didn't let myself be detected until..."
A pause. Lumia's eyes were remarkably expressive. She seemed very touched by the ship's attention. Jason imagined that nobody, nothing, had shown any interest in her well-being for a long, long time.
"It says you created a Force disturbance in the Galatter system, and that a combination of your wake and the fact you were looking for the red-headed child and the impression that the crew of your ship left in the Force made you trackable before you magnified your presence."
"My, it's got a lot to say for itself."
"You can have it, if you wish."
"Quaint, but I'm not a collector."
Jason heard himself talking simply to fill the empty air, because his mind was racing.
"I can be tracked. I can be tracked by the way those around me react, even though I'm concealed."
Yes, wake was the precise word.
"It seems made for you."
Lumia took a little audible breath, and the silky dark blue fabric across her face sucked in for a moment to reveal the outline of her mouth.
"The woman who's more machine, and the machine that's more creature."
She put one boot on the ramp.
"Very well. I'll find a use for this. I'll take it off your hands, and nobody need ever see it."
These days, Jason was more interested by what Lumia didn't say than what she did. There was no discussion of the test she'd set for Ben, and why it had taken him to Zeost and into a trap. He teetered on the edge of asking her outright, but he didn't think he could listen to either the truth or a lie. Both would rankle. He turned to go. Inside a day, the Anakin Solo would be back on Coruscant, and he would have both a war and a personal battle to fight.
"Ask me,"
she called to his retreating back.
"You know you want to."
Jason turned.
"What? Whether you intended Ben to be killed? Or who I have to kill to achieve full Sith mastery?"
I know the answer to one, but not the other.
Jason decided there was a fine line between a realistically demanding test of Ben's combat skills and deliberately trying to kill him. He wasn't sure if Lumia's answer would tell him what he needed to know anyway.
"There's another question," he said, "and that's how long I have before I face my own test."
The Sith sphere ticked and creaked, flexing the upper section of its webbed wings. Lumia stood on the edge of the hatch and looked around for a moment, as if she was nervous about entering the hall.
"If I knew when, I might also know who," she said. "But all I feel is soon and close."
Something seemed to reassure her, and she paused as if listening again. Perhaps the ship was offering its own opinion.
"And you know that, too. Your impatience is burning you."
Of course it was. Jason wanted an end to it all, to the fighting, the uncertainty, the chaos. The war beyond mirrored the struggle within. Lumia was telling the truth. Soon. Meeting of the Clans, Mandal Motors Hall, Keldabe, capital of Mandalore. 100 or so of the hardest-looking males and females that Fett had ever seen were gathered in the stark, charcoal-gray granite building that Mandal Motors had donated to the community. The hardest face of all was that of his granddaughter. Myrta Gev watched him from the side of the meeting hall with his father's eyes.
"My own eyes."
Fearfek. She really did have the Fett eyes. Maybe he was seeing what wasn't really there, but the look bored through into his soul anyway. It was a look that said, "You failed." He didn't hear the murmur of voices around him, just the soundless accusations that his daughter Aelin was dead, that he had never been there for her until it was too late, and that he might also be too late to start being a worthy Mandalore. His father had groomed him to be the best, and even if he'd never mentioned being Mandalore one day, it went with the legacy. Jaster's legacy.
"Better be quick, then. I'm dying. I've got business to take care of. Priorities. A cure. Then find out what happened to my wife. What happened to Sintas Vel."
It wasn't that Myrta wouldn't tell him. She didn't know. She had the Heart of Fire gem he'd given Sintas as a wedding gift, but it had turned up at a dealer's shop. It was just bait, and he'd taken it. But Fett being Fett, it was more than bait. It was a motivator. It was another piece of evidence.
"It's never too late to find out. I thought it was, but it's not."
The hubbub of the chieftains of the clans, heads of companies, and an assortment of veteran mercenaries faded voice by voice into silence. They watched him warily. Not all of them were human, either. A Tagorian and a Mandalian, both wearing impressive armor, leaned against the far wall, massive arms folded across their chests. Species didn't matter much to Mandalorians. Culture defined them. Fett wondered what that made him.
"Oya."
It was muttered at first, then shouted a few times.
"Oya."
It was a word with 100 meanings for Mandalorians. This time it meant, "Let's go, let's get on with it." They always started their gatherings this way, and this was the nearest Mandalorians ever came to a senate. They didn't go in for procedural nicety. A chieftain with an ornately shaved beard and an eye patch, stood up to speak without ceremony.
"So, Mandalore," he said, "are we going to fight or what?"
"Who do you want to fight?"
Fett noted that they reverted to basic when addressing him, in deference to his ignorance of Mandoa.
"The Galactic Alliance, Corellia, some force-forsaken pit on the rim."
"There's never been a war we haven't fought in."
"There is now. This isn't our fight. Mandalore's got its own troubles."
"The war's escalating. Their troubles might come and find us."
Fett stood by the long, narrow window that ran the height of the west-facing wall. It was more like an arrow loop than a view on the city. Mandalorians built for defense, and public buildings were expected to serve as citadels, even more so now. The Yuuzhan Vong had wreaked terrible vengeance on Mandalore for its covert work for the New Republic during the invasion. But the carnage had just made Mandoade more ferociously determined to stay put. The nomadic habit was still there. It was more about a refusal to yield than love of the land. But they couldn't lose a third of the population and shrug it off. Not while many still remembered the Imperial occupation.
"Sore losers, the Vong. But it's not like I had any alternative. Better the New Republic than the Crab Boys."
Fett scanned the hall, aware of Myrta's fixed and almost baleful stare.
"What's the first rule of warfare?"
On seats, on benches, leaning in alcoves, or just standing with arms folded, the leaders of Mandalorian society, or as many as could get to Keldabe, watched him carefully. Even the head of Mandal Motors, Jir Yomaget, wore traditional armor. Most had taken off their helmets, but some hadn't. That was okay by Fett. He kept his on, too.
"What's in it for us?"
said a thick-set human man, leaning back in a chair that seemed to have been cobbled together from crates.
"Second rule is, how much is in it for us?"
"So, what is in it for us this time?"
Us. Fett was Mandalore, chieftain of chieftains, commander of supercommandos, and he couldn't avoid the us any longer. He didn't feel like us. He felt like an absent husband who'd sneaked home to find an angry wife demanding to know where he'd been all night, not sure how to head off the inevitable argument. They made him feel uncomfortable. He examined the feeling to see what was causing it.
"Not up to the job."
He might have been the best bounty hunter, but he didn't think he was the best Mandalore, and that unsettled him, because he had never been simply adequate. He expected to excel. He'd taken on the job. Now he had to live up to the title, which was much, much easier in war than in peacetime. Fen Shisa must have thought he could do it, though. His dying wish was to have Fett assume the title, whether he wanted it or not.
"Crazy Barv."
The thick-set Mondo shrugged.
"Credits, Mandalore. We need currency, in case you hadn't noticed.
To spend on importing food."
"That's the idea."
"I suppose that's one way of balancing supply and demand."
"What is?"
"Back one side or the other in this war. That'll reduce the number of mouths to feed. Dead men don't eat."
There were snickers of laughter and comments in Mandoa this time.
Fett made a mental note to program his helmet translator to deal with it. And that felt like the ultimate admission of defeat for a leader. He couldn't speak the language of his own people. But they didn't seem to care.
"I'm with the Mandalore on this,"
said a hoarse male voice at the back of the assembly. Fett recognized that one. Neth Brallor. He'd known a few Brallors in his time, but they weren't all from the same clan. It was a common name, sometimes simply an indication of roots in Norg Brahl or another Hillfort town.
"We lost nearly 1.5 million people fighting the Vongese. That might be small change for Coruscant, but it's a disaster for us. No more. Not until we get Mandayayim in order. We'll eat Bas Nerall if we have to."
A murmur of rumbling agreement rippled around the hall. A few chieftains slapped their gauntlets on their armor in approval. One of them was the woman commando Fett had met in Zeria's Andral, Isco Talgal. Her expression was still as grim, graying black hair scraped back from her wind-tanned face and braided with silver beads, but she banged her fist on her thigh plate in enthusiastic approval. Fett wondered what she looked like when she was unhappy.
"You wanted a decision from me. You got it."
Fett felt time accelerating past him, and it eroded what little patience he had. Every bone in his body ached right through to his spine.
"Galactic Alliance or Confederation? You think it's going to make any difference to us?"
"No,"
said another voice, thick with a northern Concordian accent.
"Coruscant won't be asking us to disarm any time soon. They might need us if they get another Vongese war."
"Chakar!"
someone laughed. But the debate picked up pace, still mostly in basic.
"And what if the war comes too close to home? What if it spreads to a neighboring system or two?"
"Even if we side with the Alliance, what's to say they won't turn on us and expect us to toe their nice, tidy, disarmed line?"
"It's not disarmament they want. It's pooling every planet's assets into the GA Defense Force. And we all know how slick and efficient that's going to be."
Fett stood back and watched. It was both uplifting and entertaining in its way. It was the kind of decision-making process that could happen only in a small population of ferociously independent people, who knew immediately when it was time to stop being individuals and come together as a nation.
"Funny. That's the last thing Mandalore is. A nation. Sometimes we fight on different sides. We're scattered around the galaxy. We're not even one species. But we know what we are and what we want. And that's not going to change any time soon."
The arguments were all coming down to one thing. A lot of people needed the credits. Times were still tough. Fett brought his fist down hard on the nearest solid surface, a small table, and the crack brought the hubbub of discussion to a halt.
"Mandalore has no position on the current war, and there'll be no divisions over it," he said. "Anyone who wants to sell their services individually to either side, that's your business. But not in Mandalore's name."
He braced for the eruption of argument from the sudden silence, thumbs hooked in his belt. His helmet's wide-angle vision caught a fully armored figure standing at the rear of the hall. It wasn't always possible to tell if a Mondo in armor was male or female, but Fett was sure this was a man, medium height, and with his hands clasped behind his back. The left shoulder plate of his purple-black armor was a light metallic brown. It wasn't unusual to see odd-colored plates, because many Mandalorians kept a piece of a dead loved one's armor.
but this was striking for a reason Fett couldn't work out. Something glittered in the central panel of the man's breastplate, a tiny point of light as the sun cut across the chamber in a shaft so sharp and white that it seemed solid.
I should do that. I should wear a piece of Dad's armor with my own, every day.
He felt bad that he didn't, but jerked his attention back to the meeting.
That's okay, then,
said a cheerful white-haired man, sitting a few paces from him. A dark blue tattoo of a vine emerged from the top of his armor and ended under his chin. Baltan Kerid, that was his name. Fett had last seen him dispatching Yuuzhan Vong with a battered Imperial-era blaster at Kalula Station.
That's all we needed to know, that there's no ban on mercenary work.
I'll make it clear to both sides that there's no official involvement in their dispute, Fett said. But if any of you want to get yourselves killed, it's your call.
So we might see Mondo fighting Mondo in this Arue Tise's war.
Everyone looked around at the man in the purple armor. Fett saw no need to learn the language, but there were words he couldn't avoid. Arue Tise. Non-Mandalorians. Occasionally pejorative, but usually just a way of saying not one of us.
Hardly conducive to restoring the nation, is it?
But fighting's our number one export, said Kerid. What do you want? Make Keldabe into a tourist spot or something?
He roared with laughter.
I can see it now. Visit Mandalore before Mandalore visits you. Take home some souvenirs. A slab of ooj cake and a smack in the mouth.
Well, our economic policy right now seems to be to earn foreign credits, get killed, and neglect the planet.
Kerid had a magnificent sneer. He was far more intimidating without a helmet.
You got a better idea? Oh, wait. Is this going to be the all-day diatribe on Kadikla self-determination and statehood? "'Cause I ain't getting any younger, son, and I'd like to be home in time for dinner, "'cause my missus is making pea-flour dumplings.'
That got a lot of laughs. Kerid generally did. There were shouts and guffaws.
"'Yeah, we know about the dumplings, Kerid.'
"'But Kadikla?' So the Mandalore First Movement had a name now, even its own adjective, too. He hadn't come across Kadika yet, the man they said was driving the new nationalism. Fett thought that was remiss of the man, seeing as he'd done just what was asked of him and returned to lead Mandalore.
Critical mass. Nervode.
Purple Man ignored the howls of laughter. His voice had the tone of someone who'd argued this many times before.
We have a population of fewer than 3 million here, and maybe as many as 3 times that in diaspora. We lost a lot of our best troops, our farmlands been poisoned, and our industrial infrastructure is still shot to Haran after 10 years. So maybe this is the ideal time to bring some people home. Gather in the exiles while the rest of the galaxy is busy.
Kerid was focused on the debate now, and Fett was temporarily forgotten.
Yeah, group up to make a nice easy target. All of us in one place.
Nobody except the Vongees has attacked us in a long time.
The Empire gutted us. You've got a short memory. Or maybe you were still in diapers when Shisa had to kick some pride back into us.
Okay, so let's abandon Mandalore. Go totally nomad again. Keep moving. Rely on the whim of every government except our own.
Son, we are the Shabla government, Kared said. So what do you want to do about it?
Consolidate Mandalore and the sector. Bring our people home. And build something nobody's ever going to overrun again.
Purple Man had a faint accent. A little Coruscanti, a little Keldabian.
A citadel. A power base. So we choose when we stay home and when we go expeditionary.
Funny, I thought that was just what we were doing.
Fett watched the exchange, fascinated. Then he realized everyone was staring at him, waiting for him to respond, or at least to call a halt. So this was leadership off the battlefield. It was just like running his business, only more complex, more variables, more unknowns. He hated unknowns, and something that was utterly alien to him. Responsibility for other people, millions of them, but people who could take care of themselves and ran the place well enough without any bureaucracy.
Or me. Do they need me at all?
What's your name?
Fett asked. Purple Man was leaning against the wall, but he pushed himself away from it with a shrug to stand upright.
Grodd, he said.
Okay, Grodd. It's policy as of now. I'm asking for 2 million folks to return to Mandalore. How many you think we'll get?
It made sense. The planet needed a working population. It needed extra hands to clean up the soil that the Vongese had poisoned and to cultivate the land left fallow by dead owners. But every Mandalorian in the galaxy didn't add up to a single town on many planets.
We're still short on credits, until we become self-sufficient in food production again.
We'll contribute half our profits, said the Mandal Motors chief. As long as we can sell fighters and equipment to either side, of course.
Business is business.
Fett gave him an acknowledging nod.
I'll chip in a few million creds, too.
Kared looked around him as if to single out anyone mad enough to dissent, but everyone had what they wanted from the meeting. Myrta still managed to look baleful. The slice of her mother's heart of fire stone dangled on a leather cord around her neck. At least she had a decent helmet now, apparently her first. So that showed just how much of a Mandalorian her father had been, or how little she'd seen of him.
Maybe Mondo fathers have been disappointing her all her life.
One last thing, Fett said. I'm going to be away from base for a few days. Uncontactable.
How will we notice? Someone muttered. It was a fair point.
So I'm not the governing kind. But I haven't let you down yet. While I'm away, Goron Bevin stands in for me.
There was no dissent. Bevin was solid and trustworthy, and he didn't want to be Mandalore. He was also a complete savage with a Beskad, an ancient Mandalorian iron saber, as many Yuuzhan Vong had discovered the hard way. Any argument about the isolationist policy in Fett's absence wouldn't last long.
"We're done here," said Kared. "You give me the inventory of all the farmland lying fallow, and my clan will make sure it gets allocated to whoever returns to farm it."
He hung back for a moment and made an exaggerated job of replacing his helmet.
"I'm glad you brought Django home, Mandalore. It was the right thing to do."
Was it? Home for his father was Concord Dawn. It was right for Mandalore, maybe. They liked their figureheads where they could see them, even their dead ones.
"Nobody has to listen to me if they don't feel like it,"
Never known you to stay out of a fight. You've got your reasons. That's why we're listening.
Carid paused. I'm sorry about your daughter.
Yeah.
So everyone knew about Aelin. Fett didn't remember telling anyone that she was dead, let alone that Jason Solo had killed her. Mandalore wasn't her home either. She wouldn't have appreciated ending up buried here.
And I bet you're all wondering why that Jedi isn't a pile of smoking charcoal by now.
Like I said, you have your reasons. Anything we can do, just say the word.
His time will come. Leave him to me. But not now,
Fett thought. He had to get back to the hunt for a clone with gray gloves and his best chance of a cure for his terminal illness. As the hall cleared, Myrta was left standing alone, arms folded, leaning against the wall.
I wonder if Cal Omus has such an easy time in the Senate, she said.
You can't rule Mandalorians. You just make sensible suggestions they want to follow.
Fett walked outside and swung his leg over the seat of the speeder that Bevin had lent him, wincing behind his visor. He was close to giving in to daily painkillers.
And since when have Mandalorians needed to be told what makes sense?
Since they got in the habit of Baslan Shavelaw when situations didn't look winnable.
Fett remembered that phrase. Bevin had used it a lot in the Yuuzhan Vong War. It translated as strategic disappearance, scattering and going to ground in uncertain times. It was hard to wipe out a people that fragmented like mercury droplets and waited for the right time to coalesce again. It wasn't retreat. It was lying in wait.
Come on, he said. I've got some leads to follow up on the clone.
Myrta scrambled onto the pillion seat. Her armor clanked against his. She had the full set now, even a jetpack, courtesy of Bevin.
Has it ever taken you this long to track somebody? It's been months.
Don't push it. I make it about 65 days.
You believe he exists, then?
You wouldn't lie to me again, and you wouldn't make up the name Skirata.
No. You want me to come with you?
You think I need a nurse?
I said I wouldn't lie to you again.
Fett almost wished he hadn't told her. He really should have told Bevin first. That was a man he could trust. As the speeder swooped over Keldabe and out into the countryside beyond, the scale of the Yuuzhan Vong's retribution became all too clear again. The course of the winding Kalita River was visible for kilometers now, because most of the woodland surrounding it had been flattened. Keldabe stood on a bend in the river, a defiant flat-topped hill glittering with granite. And Mandal Motors' 100-meter tower had somehow survived the war, despite the damage it had sustained. The shattered stone and scorch marks were still there as a reminder that Mandalore could be battered, bruised, and temporarily subdued, but never completely conquered. The small settlements of tree homes in the branches of the slow-growing ancient Veshok forest had been wiped off the face of the map. Beneath the speeder there were no longer patches of crops in clearings. There was blackened soil and charcoal stumps of trees. And still nothing grew, not even the seedlings that usually emerged after fires.
Scum,
Fett cursed. He banked the speeder sharply and heard Myrta hold her breath.
They didn't even try to plant their Vong weeds here. They just poisoned the soil.
It was a high price to pay for double-crossing the invaders, but the alternative would have been much, much worse.
No help from the New Republic or the GA?
Myrta said. No reconstruction funding like everyone else?
We didn't expect anything. And we didn't get it.
Fett gunned the speeder's drives and headed out over the countryside, mindful of the fact that he'd have taken on the Yuuzhan Vong even if they'd been the New Republic's best buddies. The Bevin Vassar farm appeared in the distance almost on cue as a kind of reassurance that the devastation wasn't global. And there was Slave One, sitting on a makeshift landing pad. That was home. His ship. His father's ship. The cockpit where he had spent literally years of his life.
So am I coming with you or not?
Myrta was more trouble left to her own devices. Besides, he didn't want to let that Heart of Fire necklace stray too far. It was the one link he had to finding out how Sintas had died.
Okay,
he said. She was his grandchild, even if she had tried to kill him. He didn't care about that, but he struggled to find that protective devotion he'd seen in his own father. Something just didn't click. So he acted it out, because that was how he'd learned everything that became second nature to him. He went through the motions until it was part of him. He could learn to be a good grandfather, too. He could excel at it.
What's the best way to find another bounty hunter?
Think like him?
Fett shook his head and set the speeder down with a thud. He'd have to tell Bevin where he was going. If anything happened to him, Goron Bevin was his chosen successor. Fett hadn't told him yet, but Bevin took that kind of news in his stride.
No, Fett said. You hire him.